Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Line. I'm your host, Eli Sussman. Starting a restaurant can be an agonizing decision and a lengthy process. Concept development, fundraising, finding real estate, lawyers, architects, landlords. Then you have to go out and hire staff, and then you actually have to do all the cooking. Working the line and even being embedded in a quality organization doesn't fully prepare a chef for the rigors and mental challenges of opening and running a restaurant. So why do it? Why do we do it? Why did my guest today do it more than once? Why do hundreds of thousands of people dream about it? Why not say, be a consultant with flexible and more realistic hours? Today's episode, like many others of the line, is about opening spots. Today is also a little bit about closing spots, but it's also about starting again and finding new avenues, directions, and culinary pursuits. It's about my guest finding a new version of himself, perhaps, and creating a new place in the New York City culinary world after being deeply embedded in restaurants in the most classic sense, as a line cook, a sous chef, a chef de cuisine, executive chef, and then an owner. Chef Chris Jackal has an extensive resume. He spent 7 years with Union Square Hospitality Group, with Tabla and 11 Madison Park. He was the sous chef at Morimoto and also worked alongside Michael White at Altima Rea Group as CDC of Afiori when it was awarded a Michelin star and 3 stars from the New York Times. In 2013, he launched his own restaurant, partnering with Zach and Jeffrey Chatterau, in a high-end Italian restaurant in the West Village called Alanda. But he didn't stop there. He also opened Uma Tamaqueria in Chelsea, and there was a location in Gotham West Market as well. When it opened, Uma was the nation's first fast casual style eatery featuring fresh customer designed temaki, which is a cone-shaped hand roll style of sushi. But in 2016, Alanda shuttered after about 2 years being open, and later on, Uma Tamaqueria also shuttered. Jackal was named Eater's 2014 New York City Chef of the Year, and now he runs Kitchen Connect Consulting, which focuses on menu development for several concepts ranging from French brasseries to Latin taquerias, airport dining, and also there is an Alanda in Dubai. Today we're going to discuss working alongside some of the finest chefs in the world, branching out on your own, when to make the difficult decision to open and also a difficult decision to shut down, and how to launch a consulting restaurant business. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Eli.
Okay, so we have a lot to cover. You've done a lot of things. I want to start off by asking, though, even though it's impossible in a cooking career to really cook everything, you have covered a lot of ground. Tabla, Indian, Alanda was sort of an Italian with Japanese influences, Uma and Morimoto, much more heavily influenced by Japanese. Sure. You do a lot of consulting now. So I'm going to just, first question, I'm going to put you on the spot. Can you define your personal style? Is there a culinary a lane that's rooted through all your styles?
It's an interesting question. I will say, and people ask me what my favorite things to cook are or what my favorite cuisines are, and it's tough to answer because I love different things about all of them. But I will say stylistically, I would say simple, right? And it would be taking quality ingredients and treating them, you know, minimally, which is what draws me towards Italian and Japanese. They're certainly my favorite cuisines to eat, while Indian is actually my favorite cuisine to cook, right? I find it so just invigorating, the level of technique and the adding spices at different times and how drastically different the flavor profiles can be by such a little tiny tweak, like adding the cumin after the coriander seed is an example, or anything like that. So I find cooking that cuisine to be really, really energizing and entertaining. That being said, I don't enjoy eating it as much as I enjoy eating Japanese and Italian. And I find that, you know, that cuisine was sort of created through covering up inferior products, right? That's not what it is any longer necessarily, but that's sort of why it was there.
So you mean like heavily spiced because maybe the meat wasn't of the highest quality?
Yes. Okay. So it was there, you know, and even the spicing through the spice trade into Europe, that stuff was there to cover up rotting ingredients, right? Mm-hmm. To really sort of hide the, you know, lack of quality, where the Italians and the Japanese really focus on the quality and the freshness and the treatment of those ingredients. And that's what, so the short answer to that is I've described my cuisine and my cooking style as simple and sort of paying attention to the quality of the ingredient.
You grew up in New York, right?
I did.
And mm-hmm. we were talking about your last name right before we went on air. I was trying to drill down the etymology of it, but your grandmother is Sicilian.
She is.
So was that a classic sort of grandmother who's from Italy relationship? Did she do Sunday cooking? Were you there in the house at her knee working and being put to work?
So I am, for better or worse, right? My parents are divorced when I was young. I was just turned seven. So I, you know, and I was left in a position where my mom, you know, hadn't finished college and like had two kids and was in her late 20s and was like, right. So she went back to school. And that left me and my brother sort of, what do we do? So we went to my grandparents' house every day. And my grandmother was a live at home mom. That was the norm then, maybe not quite the norm, but at least for my grandparents, it was the norm. And she, you know, had a garden in her backyard, and I grew up eating cucumbers that were picked from a plant, and, you know, wild strawberries and fresh tomatoes, and, you know, bell peppers and cider vinegar was a snack, not, you know, salt and vinegar potato chips is an example, right? There was bell peppers in the backyard. So that was certainly influential to me from the fact that I grew up not eating McDonald's and foods out of a can, and which was the staples of the 80s and 90s. It's thankfully not necessarily that any longer, well, at least to some extent in our environments.
So you were able to experience that classic cooking, even though your parent didn't necessarily have the time and the ability to cook dinner every single night. She was really busy. I'm curious if your grandparents were strict and if that made it so that, you know, were you very studious? Were you sort of a troublemaker because your mom wasn't around and you had a little bit of leeway? What was the young Chris like in Brooklyn?
I would say that I was, early on, I was a stickler to the rules, right? As soon as I was allowed to my own devices, things changed a little bit, right? Like by the time I was 14, I became a latchkey kid, right? I was old enough to sort of do my thing. I went to seventh and eighth grade. I walked home or didn't walk home, you know, from school was 7 through 12 at the time. So, you know, the influence of the older kids, and I sort of separated myself from the excelling studiously into riding a skateboard. And, you know, you can imagine what those sort of things were like at the time. I want to just one more point. A studious, strict thing. My grandfather was a deputy inspector. He ran two police precincts in Brooklyn. So you can imagine what discipline was like in that household.
And so what did that lead to? Like what was the teenage Chris like when you were maybe got an inkling that food would be something that would be part of your life? You ended up going to Johnson & Wales. So you made a decision at a certain point that you were going to pursue culinary school. Was there a first job or a moment when you said, I need to earn some money, and you ended up being involved in food either because of passion or necessity?
Sure. So I always worked, like even from a very young age. Like I was stuffing penny savers and had a paper route, you know, when I was like 9, 10 years old. I have a feeling someone called child services on my parents now for something like that. But
it played back then. It's fine.
It did. So my first job outside of school was at a grocery store. So I was, a leveler or like a stock boy, essentially. So I was actively involved in leveling aisles and produce and sort of that was, you know, intimate sort of experience, touching, feeling food. But I was 16, I believe. I mean, I remember the moment. I was certainly early junior year of high school. And I was, as I had alluded to earlier, once high school came around, I was sort of fending for myself during the day. So I cooked a lot for myself and my younger brother. And I was making Ortega taco mix, right? And I was like, the tacos are toasting in the oven. And I'm searing the beef. And like that little MSG cumin pack goes in. And I'm smelling it. And I'm like, you know, I think I could do this for a living. So I went to my guidance counselor like within a day or two and said, hey, you know, Mr. Sclafani, I think was his name. I think this is what I want to do. And they kind of tried to talk me out of it. And I said, you know, this is really what I want to do. So I enrolled. I was, you know, as I said earlier, I was studious when I was younger, and I sort of morphed away from being engaged, for lack of a better term, in high school. But that did put me in a position where I was in accelerated math and science. So I was a year ahead in math and science. I was in honors English and social studies. So, and I was a year behind in Spanish. So I knew everybody in high school because I didn't get languages, but math and science apparently worked. So I, by the time my senior high school came around, I had the capacity to take nothing but electives. So I was only required to take English and social studies and gym. Those are the only things I had to take my senior year. So I explored going to Johnson Wales early. They had accepted me in for a program to skip my senior high school and take the last of my high school credits at Johnson Wales. I decided I was not mature enough for that, so I enrolled in vocational school, which is BOCES in New York, in a town called Westbury on Long Island. So I went from like 7 a.m. to 11 a.m. I went to cooking school. We made lunch for the school, kids came in, and then I took a bus back to my regular high school, and I took the three classes I was required to. And so, yeah, I mean, I ended up going to culinary school in high school, so I was pretty – when I pick something that I decide I want to do, I work pretty hard towards getting it, which we can talk about how I ended up, you know, got the restaurants and got my own restaurant, et cetera, later on in the show. But when I decide I want to make a decision and I really want to pursue something, I work pretty hard to getting there.
So once you get into Johnson & Wales and you're working there and – you see what the next stage is, which is, all right, you're going to graduate, you're going to go out into the world and work at a restaurant. What was that like? Did you go to Union Square Hospitality Group first? Did you work at other places?
Sure. So through, you know, we talked a little bit about the economic, well, maybe not the economics, but the situation my family was in. So, you know, money wasn't exactly flowing, for lack of a better term. So at Johnson & Wales, I worked, as always. At night, I worked in a place called Roma Gourmet for a couple of years. And then I had the opportunity to become a teacher's assistant, a fellow, which was like 50% scholarship to schooling. So I took that. So I did that throughout. And then I did practicum, which was what they called it, which was essentially me doing an internalized internship. So I worked for the Johnson & Wales Inn. They owned a hotel at the time. So I did my internship in their hotel property. So I did that throughout college, and then getting into my first quote-unquote real restaurant, my grandparents lived across the street from Larry Forgione. So I wrote Larry Forgione a letter when people wrote letters, you know, and I said, hey, I'm graduating from Johnson & Wales. I'd really like to come work for you. So he gave me the opportunity. I worked at American Place for about a year and a half or so before straight out of Johnson & Wales.
It's a good first job.
Yes, it was pretty solid. It was a little, you know, to be fair, I was a little frustrated by being, my mom forced me to go to college. Mm-hmm. It was if you want to be a chef, you need to get a bachelor's degree, because when you're 28 and you realize this isn't what you want to do, you can go get a master's degree and get a real job.
Okay.
Right? Was yeah. Sort of where we landed.
How practical, mom.
You know, well, she's an accountant. but I was a little bit, I mean, yes, it's a great first job, but I could have gotten that first job at 18 and not 21, right? Like that's, and
sure.
At the time anyway, this was a business, and I still to some extent believe that this is still that business where it's merit-based. Like you do a better job than the guy next to you. It doesn't matter whether you're blue or green or orange or Afghani or Mexican or Italian, or you work harder than the guy next to you and you do a better job than the guy next to you, like you're going to get promoted. And it's one of the only industries, I think, in this country that is that diverse from an opportunity perspective. And so I'm maybe this is a tangent, but I'm still a little bit salty about it because I would have gotten the same job working in the same place 3 years earlier. Would I have been 3 years ahead in my career if I had done that? I don't know. I mean, there's benefits to college. I'm not telling people not to go to college right now. Right? Like, but, you know, I had sort of explored and it was clear that school was not keeping me engaged, right, at least in high school. And this wasn't something that truly kept me engaged. And my mom finally signed on. I got my first, I don't know, report card or whatever, and it was a 4.0 at Johnson & Wales, and she was like, oh, so you've been getting C's, and all the teachers have been telling me that you're not living up to your potential, and you're sleeping in their classes, and you just got straight A's. All right, maybe I should be supporting this.
So all it took was really finding something that you just wanted to pay attention to.
And I think that goes for anyone, not just me, right? Like, you know, the ability and the capacity for parents to allow their children to choose what they're passionate about, I do think culture is shifting to allow that almost to a negative extreme, mm-hmm. where it's sort of just, sure, do whatever you want, rather than providing discipline and that sort of thing. But I think that that's really the key for anyone in a from a professional standpoint, is picking something you truly enjoy doing. And yes, it's work, and there are days you don't love it, but the fact that you enjoy it outweighs the negatives and the hard days that make it difficult.
Yeah, a good job can be as instructional, or if not more so, than school, because you are actually learning these practical applications in a real world environment. You're not sitting in a class saying, "And how do you balance a book, a checkbook?" It's like mm-hmm. you are inside of a business and figuring out these things firsthand. So you work for Larry Forgione at his restaurant, and I imagine that was really a pretty buttoned up work environment, right? Like probably pretty the constructs for what you did in the kitchen were probably pretty firm, right? Was there a lot of leeway in that kitchen?
I've never worked in a place that I would classify as loose. Like, it just doesn't, I'm not built that way. Well, I'm in t-shirt and sneakers, and I like that in my personal life. I like to be able to be comfortable and sort of react that way. But you know, I miss the days of the long white aprons and the clean uniforms. And I just think that, you know, the short answer is no, it was not loose. And I prefer it that way. I think that discipline is something people seek out from the hospitality industry.
So besides the fact that you like a very structured work environment, what were some other really great big takeaways from Union Square Hospitality Group? You spent a ton of time there. You worked at two large, sprawling restaurants that were both very well regarded and I assume extremely busy when you were there.
Sure.
So you kind of, not to put words in your mouth, but you kind of grew up as a person the first 7 years of your restaurant career in Union Square Hospitality Group. Was it extremely formative, or was there just little pieces here and there that were important?
Sure. You know, it's interestingly, we can get to this in a little while, but I think I actually grew up officially as a person through Steven Starr's company in Morimoto. I mean, listen, I was 22 to 29, right? Like, in New York City, and I became a sous chef at 24 years old, right? Like, I was an arrogant, cocky little, you know, like a better term, right? I was, and that's something that, you know, I don't know if I regret it, but it's certainly learned from it. And so what were my takeaways? I mean, I was fortunate enough to work for three different chefs. So that company at the time was really driven on creativity. So I got to really sort of get a understanding and a look at three very different perspectives on food. And that was really what I was focused on. And when I say I grew up with Steven Starr, I left Union Square knowing very little about the business. I didn't learn at Johnson & Wales because at the time they shared very little with us, right? We were there to be executors and creative. And so I grew from a culinary perspective leaps and bounds. While I don't think I grew as a human necessarily and as a manager until after I moved on from the company, which I think would sound surprising to a lot of people based on their impressions of Union Square Hospitality Group and how they operate. But that was my own personal takeaway. I excelled and grew exponentially culinarily, but didn't really change as a human until I moved into a little bit more of a financially, economically driven environment, which would be Steven Starr's company.
And so, do you think that has to do with the fact, was there more transparency at Morimoto and the Steven Starr company? Was it the role that you took on there, or was it the place that you were personally in life? Like, what led to those changes when you made the jump to Morimoto?
Sure. It's a little bit of both. Transparency is the big one, right? I was not given access to the majority of financials in Union Square Hospitality Group, where I was given access to everything in Steven Starr's organization. So that was really a position that I felt like I was a weak point for me, right? Like, I knew I could cook at this point, right? I knew I could expedite. I knew I could run a busy restaurant. I didn't know if I could figure out how to deal with these and hitting budgets and numbers and payroll and that sort of stuff. So the transparency was really big for me. The secondary thing was, listen, I was 29. I was entering my 30s. You start looking at life a little bit differently. The third thing I will say is it was the I don't know whether people want to hear this that have worked there. It was the easiest job I had ever had. Right? It was just like it was easy. Like, I don't mean that to be like cocky.
In what way?
The menu didn't change a lot, and you know, it was structured in such a way that systemization was there. So it was literally like, I just wrote a list every day. I did my job. I went home, right? I was responsible for the prep team. I made all the sauces. I learned so much about Japanese cuisine and a true appreciation for it. But it was not this environment where you had the leadership driving hard to change and to get better and to better is not the right necessary word, but this constant move forward. There wasn't this constant mentality of like, okay, we did that yesterday, let's do this differently tomorrow. Like it left me the time and the ability to absorb and to learn all of these other administrative things and functional things that I didn't necessarily have the capacity to deal with because I wasn't being driven so hard from a culinary perspective.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, in a lot of places, like, there's really only one lane, and that lane is you're a cook. Here's the goalpost for today. Tomorrow, show up. We're going to move that goalpost. Oh, you picked up 100 plates today and you did them perfectly? Great. Tomorrow, you're going to pick up those same plates, but you're going to do them 5 seconds faster and 5% sure. cleaner.
Sure.
You were opened up to a new avenue that allowed you to see what other pieces of the business looked like, right? Yeah. And it's not – at a certain point, some people want to grow beyond being a CDC and being just fully embedded in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
At Morimoto, was that where you started making decisions about what your own personal career could look like? Or were you defining yourself still by where you were working, or were you looking to maybe transcend the name of the restaurant and do your own thing?
Sure. So I went to Morimoto with a very specific idea, and that was to learn an Asian cuisine. And I had decided it was going to be Chinese or Japanese. And I trailed at several restaurants on both sides of that cuisine spectrum. And it was the only one that I felt I would be proud of being in. And that is, and again, I will not name any names, but like a level of cleanliness, a level of organization, a level of professionalism just didn't exist in the other restaurants that I experienced and went looking for that were open to someone like me entering the environment, right? Like a lot of those places, if I wasn't of their culture, that wasn't even an option. They might let me in the door, but you'd be sort of chastised or ignored or whatever it may be. So for me, I went in specifically wanting to learn a new cuisine. And then the secondary thing was, in terms of, I had mentioned this earlier, when I like decide I want to do something, my goal was to open a restaurant. You know, it had been since I was 18 years old. And so that goal hadn't changed. I will say that it showed me an appreciation for a cuisine that I was very unfamiliar with, that I ended up really embracing and growing a much larger passion for than I anticipated. I figured I'd spend 2 or 3 years there like I did at all the other places that I worked in and learn what I need to learn from it. And okay, so now I know how to use spices really well. And if I want to put spices in an American dish that I do, then I'll know how to add them and make them really pop and be familiar. But what I did really gain was this appreciation for the simplicity and the respect of the ingredients, which, you know, some people give me pushback that I did that at a place like Morimoto that does 600 people a night. But they really, I mean, the rice comes in brown. It gets polished every morning for the sushi rice. The dashi gets made every single day. It's not like, you know, it's not the kind of environment where they sort of are slinging it because it's so busy. They really pay attention to the core things, and that was meaningful to me.
You had a pretty sort of linear but upward trajectory. Like, you started and then you got promoted and then you got promoted and then you moved and then you got promoted. When you reflect back on sort of the main 3-4 chunks of that growth period, do you feel like you wrung everything out of that you could have? Do you look back and think to yourself, I wish I would have done X at one of those restaurants? Or did you really feel like when you moved on that you had gotten pretty much everything you could out of that specific experience?
Sure. So patience is something that I've worked very hard on understanding in the last few years. And I will say that I think that I moved a little too quickly into management roles. And I think I had a little bit of a period of stagnation in my own eyes that, well, based on my history and my resume, and a lot of people would disagree with that, I think. But from my perspective, I had a bit of a stagnant period where I, like, breaking the mold from sous chef into chef de cuisine and executive chef took a little longer than I would have liked it to. And my own personal reflection, I think, has to do with the fact that I wasn't confident in some of the core skills that I think that I had usurped by moving into management at 24. I mean, being a manager in a 3-star New York Times restaurant at 24 years old is an accomplishment, right? But I think I missed the boat on, you know, some of the core skill sets, like, you know, fish butchery or meat butchery or, like, you know, whole animal and that sort of stuff that I would have gained if I had sort of not moved at such an aggressive pace with myself. That being said, I have absorbed that information later in my life. You know, I can certainly take a pig apart, or, you know, I can butcher a fish without maybe not quite with my eyes closed, but certainly efficiently. And all those things came, truthfully, most of it through Morimoto, because I had the time and the emotional and physical capacity to absorb new skills, because it was it was such a less stressful environment than I was used to.
After Morimoto, and you had been at all these places where I imagine, you know, we're talking dozens, if not even like 100 people on the staff at some of these mm-hmm. really big restaurants. Yeah. Did you think to yourself, it might be nice to work somewhere where there's maybe 2 to 3 cooks on the line and you're banging out like 14 dishes on each station? Or is that basically the question is like, do you love those massive organizations? And is that where you always saw yourself? Or was there like a small inkling of, hey, maybe I'll go work at a really teeny sushi place, or, sure. You know,
I like structure, right? And frankly, I found it through hospitality and the restaurant industry. I didn't necessarily, I had it when I was younger, but I lost it through my teens and my early 20s, and I sort of reeled that back in through that. And I think with smaller environments, it's much more difficult to sort of enter into the stream of structure. I realize a stream and structure are sort of oxymorons, but like you sort of enter into this environment where structure is the only way to survive, right? And I find I believe structure is the only way to survive anywhere, but I will say that I craved something smaller after the fact. And that's, you know, iFury was also a massive restaurant, right? Like 40 line cooks and 14,000 square feet. And it was an absolute massive restaurant. But once that was, you know, that time passed, I had convinced myself anyway, opening something smaller was going to be easy. And that was just listen, I've been managing 40, 60, 100 people at a time. Like, how hard could it be to manage 60 total people, right? This is like, we can do this. But what you don't think about, at least what I didn't think about, was the ice machine's not working, call the maintenance guy, right? or the fire department's here, like, yeah, we got a guy to deal with that, right? Like, you know, and I ended up, and I think this has something to do with Alonda's ultimate demise. It's not the only thing by any means. I've thought about thousands of reasons why I think it wasn't embraced by New York. It certainly was embraced by the media. Is that I lost the fun in it, right? Like, that's retrospect, but I lost the desire to just cook, right? And it was because everything, I was a managing partner, so I was responsible for the health department, the fire department, the neighbor complaining about the noise, or you name it, it was the toilet overflowing, the plumbers, the contractors, you name it, it was on me, right? So while I was very, very supported financially, it was me, GM, everyone, it was every single employee came to me to get something done. And that was cool initially, but I didn't really recognize at the time how much it was weighing on me to be pulling me away from the part of it that I do this. I could have done anything I wanted in the world, right? Like, it was taking me completely away from the stuff that I like to do, which also tore me away from the creative side of it and the even desire to do it, because it was just all this stuff just like piling on the payroll and the insurance companies and whatever it may be, just constantly pulling me away from doing any of the stuff that I enjoy. And not to say that those things aren't important, because they're more important than the food, to be perfectly frank, to some extent. but it really like emotionally pulled me away from it. And that was the big lesson I learned from downsizing.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, more with Chef Chris Jackal. Stick with us here on The Line on Heritage Radio.
Are you enjoying this show? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. I'm Luke Griffin, and I'm the host of Bushwick Podcast. Each week, we share the remarkable stories of how artists, activists, and entrepreneurs collide in Bushwick, a special Brooklyn neighborhood that's changing faster by the day. You can find Bushwick Podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Welcome back to The Line here on Heritage Radio. I'm your host, Eli Sussman. My guest today is Chef Chris Jackal. He's worked pretty much everywhere along the sort of higher-end spectrum in New York. He was at Afiore with Michael White in Alta Maria Group. He worked at Tabla and 11 Madison Park and for Morimoto. And after all of those learning experiences, he decided to go out on his own and open up a restaurant. Chris, let's talk about how you sort of formulated your team and your plan to open up that restaurant. Right before the break, you articulated a lot of the challenges with being the managing partner, which is, of course, as a chef and creative director, that's a lot right there. And then to take on all those other pieces. So when you were thinking up the project and you sort of took it out to market, how did you first connect with investors? Mm-hmm. How did you find the space? And how did you conceptualize what you wanted the restaurant to be?
Sure. So I guess there's probably preface this with I'm not necessarily promoting the way we went about this. If it was an epic success, then everyone would be stroking, like, you know, like being, oh my God, you were such a genius. But I don't think it was a failure by any means. You know, we were critically acclaimed. I used my network. Right, I was introduced to someone, you know, very wealthy. That is a serial restaurateur, and we went in being really excited about something, and that's how we went. And it was, the fundraising was, you know, frankly the easiest part, right? And and that is to date been fairly simple for me. And that's just, my advice is to be passionate about something and use a network, right? Network, network, network. If you don't have, you know, you've heard the saying, the network is your net worth. That's real. So that's my first piece of advice. The secondary thing was I had had a clear understanding of what I wanted to do. And that, I think, is where I can help the most based on this question. And that is, people want to invest in restaurants because they're passionate about it. And they need to feel the passion coming from the person raising the money. And or the person creating the vision. Maybe there's a financial person putting the plan together for you, which I do recommend. But the passion is what people are investing in with restaurants, right? This is an industry that is notoriously, or at least is known to not necessarily be the type of place that's going to make you wealthy, right? So people give you money to open a restaurant because they want to be passionate about it. They want a place to go and enjoy it and believe in. And if you raise your money properly, the money that's invested in you, it shouldn't be the life-changing amount of money from any investor. Right, like they should be investing in it and enjoying it and believing in it, and it shouldn't be a life-changing experience for them if it doesn't work. So the passion is sort of where it is. And I alluded to developing a deep passion for Japan and its food through Morimoto. I, you know, had worked at an Italian-American place called Roma Gourmet in Providence for some time. It's still there, family-owned. So I'd spent 2 years there, and then I had been at Ifuri, and my grandmother is an Italian-American, so I was very passionate. And the more I spent time with these famous chefs, Michael White ate at Japanese restaurants. He went to sushi bars. It's what he did. And Morimoto, when we would talk about menu changes or Iron Chef ideas or whatever it may be, he, you know, I'd mention Indian and he'd sort of be like, And every time I'd mention Italian, he'd watch his ears perk up and he'd get more interested. And I was thinking, you know, what about these two cuisines made these two world-class chefs so excited about the other person's cuisine? So not only did I find myself enjoying these two cuisines more than I did any other cuisine, I also saw these people, iconic, being passionate about it. So there has to be some sort of connection. And through that, my research and my diligence, my passion for these two cuisines continue to increase. And that, from my perspective, is what translates into, you know, finding capital. And you look at IPOs like, I don't know, WeWork is a great example. They're in hot water right now, right? But they raised millions, if not billions of dollars based on the passion of their CEO, which could bite them long term, you know. But again, this raising capital thing, I think people put too much capital, no pun intended, into the structure of the business and the pro formas and the sort of plan and how it's going to be executed. I don't think that's where investors give money away. I really don't. I think they believe in a passion and they believe in the excitement of it, and that's where it goes. And all those other things are nice to have. And I'm not implying you don't need a pro forma if you're trying to raise money. But to be frank, that is just a meaningless piece of paper with a bunch of numbers on it. You have no idea whether you're going to do $1 million a year or $12 million a year. You have no idea, right? You have methods of where you should spend money and what's important and how and ways to market into a neighborhood. But it's an industry that's still a passion-driven industry, and you watch people that are the best chefs. I'd make the argument there's a person that I would consider the best chef in America that doesn't have a restaurant. He probably won't ever have a restaurant, and that's his personality, and it's his lack of ability to translate passion into it. You know, and that's, to me, if we're talking about how to get there and how to raise money, it's a plan is important, a pro forma is important, a story is important. But that passion coming from the person that is the creator is how you will cross the finish line on getting people to give you that capital.
When you opened, as you have said earlier in the program, it was really well regarded from a media standpoint. Mm-hmm. It got a lot of write-ups. A lot of reviewers were really excited about what you were doing. That must have felt awesome. Did it immediately translate to bodies in the dining room? Was there always a disconnect, do you think, between sort of critics and customers, or did that occur later on?
Sure. I don't want to hesitate to put words in other people's mouths, but I don't believe there were many people that came in that restaurant the first year that didn't leave saying the food was delicious, if any, right? I mean, we really delivered, from my perspective, on quality. What I think we got wrong is I think we missed I think we didn't spend enough time on a marketing plan. And with that, you asked me about the reviews and changing business. Oh, I mean, the New York Times review, we went from doing $65,000 a week to doing $105,000 a week. I mean, this was not a dud restaurant. Like, you can do the math and $100 average check of $85 and doing $105,000 a week. Like, that's a lot of people. Like, that's 300 people on a Saturday in a 90-seat restaurant. I mean, it was jamming. Mm-hmm. And I honestly think that's where we went wrong, believe it or not. I think that after the media sort of died down, we hadn't garnered our neighborhood and our core clientele. We had all these people coming in, loving us, enjoying it from, you know, Wine Spectator in San Francisco and LA and reading the Two Times and being excited and coming in. And those are not your people that sustain your business long term. Right? They all come in, they love it. And I'm not saying that, you know, some of them didn't recommend their friends and then them come back, but we did nothing to welcome our neighbors. And with that, you know, it wasn't a giant restaurant. And with that, you know, people trying to get in and saying, oh, it's a 2-hour wait when you live around the corner. Like, there's another Italian restaurant around the corner. Like, I'm going to go there instead, you know, and that's their habits. And I think that was the biggest thing. And the secondary thing, I think, was the marketing. We got engrossed in the concept of it being Italian and Japanese rather than it being engrossed in it being an Italian restaurant that happened to taste different, a little different, or I would argue better than just Italian. And I think that, you know, I had several people in food and that are not chefs or you know, food writers sort of say, like, it was really good, but it was a little weird, right? And, it kind of wasn't. It kind of just tasted good, but it was the story that was curated, and I'm completely at fault for that. And I think that is really what, when you ask me what went wrong, I think those are the two big ones.
Chefs, especially, but most entrepreneurs, in order to believe in yourself, you have to either have a true ego or just fake it and really feed your own ego and get to this point where you believe in yourself enough to solicit money from people. You have to believe that your idea is going to come true. One of the hardest things is to look at something that you created and say, perhaps it's not working, and think about all those reasons. And I'm wondering, was there a specific day, was there a week when you came to terms with, maybe not come to terms, but when you really said to yourself, like, I do not think that this restaurant is functioning in the way that we can keep going, and we should probably have a conversation about closing it. Did that occur?
Yes. This is not going to sound very exciting or passionate, but it was like the bank accounts, to be completely frank, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you raise money, if you put a decent plan together, then you had plenty of working capital to sort of execute that. And you get to a stage where, you know, we had been feeding that bank account for some time, and at some point that changed. And you sort of look at it and you say, okay, what are we going to do here? You know, we are in a position now where the trend is going in the wrong direction. We initially sort of tried some different things, you know, a simpler lunch menu or lunch at all for that matter. And, you know, maybe lost costly things, trying to look to the neighborhood. And, you know, when you get to those stages, it's probably too late, guys, right? Like, just rip the Band-Aid off. Like, I'm a firm believer, like, this should not be, it will be and is going to be an emotional experience for you and for whoever else invested in it, but it just can't be. Like, you have to look past the emotion and you have to make a decision. And if it's not working, like everyone gets themselves in trouble for it. It's the numbers just don't lie, right? They just don't, you know, and that decision should be made sooner than later. But you will know instinctively that it's time. And we gave it a lot of time. I'm not implying that, like, oh, 3 months after we stopped being profitable, we were like, let's pull the plug. That's not the case. But we tried several things and we discussed, you know, infusing some new capital in to sort of do some different things to the dining room, but really, when you're at that stage, it's probably too late. Like, just throw it in and move on and don't be emotional about it.
Were you simultaneously working on the fast casual concept when Alanda opened? Did it come later on? And how did that come to be? Since we're talking about Japanese flavor, so there is some crossover there, but from a perspective of the diner and just generally what the business model is like, it's the exact opposite of Alanda.
So I was working on them both simultaneously since before Alanda opened. I didn't quite anticipate them opening as close to each other as it ended up happening. So simultaneous is the short answer. And I just look at, I'm practical generally speaking, and you know, Alanda was the passion project, right? Which is kind of terrifying to a person like me. Because I always had health insurance and I've always saved for my retirement. And like these sort of things that were like incremental and that are abnormal necessarily for our industry. You know, I'm prepared to retire someday. You know, like these are sort of things that I've always been sort of put together. And Alanda was a risk from that perspective, from a business model and this, to me at least, appeared to be a little bit more of stable is not the right word because it's a restaurant, but it was a little bit more of a practical approach to a problem that I didn't believe had been solved yet.
And so when you put the business plan together and you found the space for Uma Tamakeria, were you splitting your time? Did you hire someone as the sort of the managing partner of that? And were you just designing the menu? Like, sort of, what was your involvement in that project, basically?
So I was a Class A shareholder. So I was an owner in the business, but it was structured as from a consultancy's perspective, right? So I was never the daily operator. I was never meant to be there day to day. I was obviously there a lot for the opening to just sort of ensure that quality was sort of where I wanted to be. But that deal was structured for me to provide the tools that would need to be provided and to sort of take a step back. And that is how it worked. So, it was open considerably longer than Alonda was. So I helped, obviously, after Alonda closed a little bit more, but I was never, my intention was to never be in that building on a consistent basis. And my deal structure was designed for that to be the case.
Not to continue, beating up on it, but you had two concepts, you poured a lot into them. Neither one of them are open right now. Sure. You've obviously been able to have great success now with your consulting business, and we're going to talk about that in one second. But for someone who's either in the business and maybe looking to make that next jump, what does that feel like? What is that actually like when you see things that you've put so much effort into and then they are no more?
Oh, it's soul crushing. Like, I don't want to like just sit here and be like, oh yeah, you just ripped the Band-Aid off. That sucked. Let's move on. I mean, it's like, it's horrible. Right. But you listen to the greatest entrepreneurs in the world and all of them will sit there and tell you fail and fail fast. Right. Like, cause you, ideas are the easy part, right? Making the execution is the hard part. And if it's not working, like just that sucked, like pick another one. Right. And then I was consulting. I had someone ask me the other day how I ended up in consulting, and I sort of just looked at it and I was like, well, that didn't work. I'm like, that sucked. Like, what do I do now? Right? And it's like, okay, do I go raise money and do it again? I'm certainly capable of doing that, and I could certainly accomplish that if I had made the choice. But I sort of said, like, the idea of doing the same thing over and over again isn't how I work either, right? That's, you can see that in my resume and the different kind of cuisines I've worked in. And so I just sort of said, all right, well, I know how to start an LLC. I know how to start a business. I know how to deal with these things now. Let me just go start my own business. I'm like, I don't need to raise money for this. I don't need to do anything like it. I have a giant network, right? And let me use that network and see if it works, right? And that was I formed the LLC in 2015, I believe. Anyway, it was certainly when Alonda was still open. And, it was initially the LLC was designed to, the extracurriculars, right? Like Kikkoman wants to send me to Napa to, do some demos for them, or Ronzoni wants to put my recipe on their website, or, whatever. I said, okay, so I'll, my parents are an accounting firm. So I was like, okay, I'll start this LLC. I'll have the money come in, right? I'll probably lose money and like I'll use it as a write-off, and like that's what it is, right? Like, so that's initially how I formed the LLC. But once it was done, I'm like, I have this LLC. I know how to build a website. I called a designer. I said, let's get a website built. This is my vision for it. I had business cards produced, and I just hit the streets. Like, I mean,
a lot easier to start the kitchen consulting business than it was
for sure
to start the fast casual and the fancy restaurant at the exact same time. I think there is some sort of people don't really have the ability to wrap their head around what a consultant does. It's such a catch-all term, but you do HACCP plans, front of house, back of house consulting. You do menu design. What do you focus on the most? Or if you do a lot of all those different things, what are you really excited about right now that you're working on?
Sure. In my ever restless culinary perspective, I just got signed on to do a giant Chinese restaurant in New Jersey. Listen, it's like, it's a 10,000 square foot property. It's enormous, right? And it's a family. I had worked with the son at 11 Messon Park years and years ago, and they reached out and said, hey, listen, they have three giant Chinese restaurants in New Jersey already. They're doing a new one. And that I'm excited about because it's a completely new experience for me, cuisine-wise, culture-wise. That's really what jazzes me. So I get really excited about doing things that are different. I did a taqueria 2 years ago in Princeton, New Jersey. Also a big restaurant. And that was just, okay, I don't have any idea how to nixtamalize corn or, you know, hand press a tortilla. Like, this is going to be a pain in the ass, but I'm also going to enjoy it. And so that's what I get the most jazzed about is through consulting, I get the opportunities to continue to feel like I'm growing on a constant basis, whether that be programming a rationale so that minimum wage employees who have never held a knife in their life can figure out a way to execute food in a fast casual, or whether it's, you know, I have a client in the Tri-State area that operates a great deal of real estate in airports. And that's like, where I found my steady niche business comes from is environments where they're not anticipating a chef of my caliber being open to learning how to program a Turbo Chef, or like learning how to put a 20 item menu together with nothing but three microwaves and like some hot hold. Like, they're like, what? And I'm like, this is fun for me. And they're like, well, really? I'm like, well, yeah, because I don't know how to think like this. Like, I have to think completely differently than my training was to even for this to even remotely work.
Yeah. It's cool because you're applying everything you've learned, which from an outside perspective, they think there's no practical applications there. They're mm-hmm. like, you're a chef, right? Like, don't you need $80,000 worth of toys? And you're like, not really. Give me a deep fryer and I'll make you a really good deep fried item if you put me in front of it.
And that's the part that I get jazzed about, because it's one of the reasons why I continue to have a business that works, knock on wood, right? Like, this is, I'm 4 years into doing this exclusively, and that is not quite as long a run as Uma, but it's pretty close, man, right? And mm-hmm. and this is this, so like, for me, I think business comes because I've developed humility through suffering and pain and failures, to be frank. But the other thing is, like, I've always been excited about learning something different, right? Like, I tend to lose focus on things once they are no longer challenging for me. And this keeps me forever being put in new environments that are challenging and keeps me engaged.
Do you find that the learning curve is as exciting as putting it into practice? Like, you're saying, I don't know how to nixtamalize corn. So you're basically going back to school, right? You're mm-hmm. you're tackling all these flavor profiles and creating recipes. And then once you get it to that point, well, you need to implement it. Sure. And then you need to go into whatever box they've built you and say, all right, I'm going to try to figure out how to make this work. Mm-hmm. Is there one side or the other that you find more enjoyable to the process?
My favorite part about what I do now is the opening, right? Because I get to watch it all come together, right? And I've been fortunate that a large portion of the work that I have been involved in, I get in early. So I'm there, like, you know, kitchen design and meeting with the builders and meeting with the contractors and sort of, you know, negotiating through it. And this is the equipment and where it's going to be and how it's going to work. And then, generally speaking, I'm around until the opening. Like, we go through hiring a chef and the chef comes in and we work through it. And I try to, you know, insert what the ownership requires while allowing that chef to feel they have ownership of it, which is really a fine line. And then I get to get through the process of watching it come together and the team being there. And that's a little, that's sort of sad for me sometimes when it's like, I'm really enjoying the opening and I'm like a month in and I'm like, all right, well, I'll see you in a month, you know, like I'll be back in for dinner later, which, you know, is sort of, you know, the team thing is a big portion of what we do. So that's a little bit of a bummer, but like, watching it come together is really exciting.
What's amazing is that you're basically doing all the same stuff that you would do if it was your restaurant, but at a certain point you're backing away and you have to turn over the reins and the keys to someone else. And part of that process is finding someone who can continue to mm-hmm. execute at what you've put in. Have you found ever in any of your consulting gigs that even after all the thought you've put in, when you turn things over, it's still sort of chefy, for lack of a better term? Or have you been able to create enough systems so that when you turn it over to people, it runs pretty smoothly, sure, even without someone of your level of expertise there in the kitchen?
Well, that's the sweet spot that I've found is my niche for the business, right? Is, you know, I helped grow a company in New Jersey from 2 to 5 restaurants. and they just sold to another larger group in New Jersey. And the sort of catch was they could hire guys that were maybe sous chefs and promote them from within, or chef de cuisines that weren't quite ready to run, you know, $4 or $5 million restaurants on their own. And I can get in there and deal with these things that they may be lacking, and help them massage them through this into an environment. So that's been really where I've landed on a lot of the things that I do. And so for me, I find that to be the best sort of case scenario. It also is the cost effective, right? Like I'm a one-off at an expense for an operator long-term. You know, they can promote someone that's been with their company or that's a sous chef for considerably less than hiring someone of my skill set, right? And then, so that, you know, all right, they got to pay for the outlay, but like maybe I come back on a quarterly basis and spend a week with them, or, you know, I come back once a month and spend a day with whatever it may be based on what their individual needs are. But, you know, I found it works for the operators, and it, to date anyway, it's worked for me.
Chris, I really appreciate you being here and sharing your whole story, your arc, and telling us all about the places you worked, the spots that you opened, and now what your consulting business is doing. If people want to find you, if they've got more questions about their own projects and maybe getting you involved from a consulting perspective, how can people find you and the work that you do?
Well, I'm on all of the channels. I will say that Instagram is the one I look at the most. At C Jekyll, J-A-E-C-K-L-E. You know, that's probably the best one. My website, kitchenconnect.co, is certainly accessible. There's my information. That's that everything you need. There's an about page as well as a page to reach out to me directly on there. I'd say those are the best channels. LinkedIn is also something that I was resistant to for quite some time, but I tend to be more active on it just from a business perspective. It seems to be effective for me at the moment, so that I'm on pretty consistently these days. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you again, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to this episode. You can find this and tons more episodes on heritageradionetwork.org, and of course you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us next Tuesday at 11 a.m. for a new episode of The Line here on Heritage Radio. The Line is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners just like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.